Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. 1 year ago this week, Azerbaijani forces attacked the region of Nagorno-Karabakh, or what the Armenians call Artsakh. This war redrew the maps of the region and shifted the power and influence in this region away from Armenians who have declared the region independent, but legally it remains a part of Azerbaijan. Ethnic cleansing and the targeting of civilians in the attack mark the war. A pro-Azerbaijan ceasefire was negotiated with Russian troops serving as peacekeepers to oversee what's best described as a fragile peace in the region. What is the current status of the region following the ceasefire and what issues remain, as well as the possibility of any sort of lasting peace in the South Caucasus region? We will explore this and the impact on the region with Anna Ohanian. She is the Richard B. Finnegan Distinguished Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Stonehill College. She's the author of The Neighborhood Effect, The Imperial Roots of Regional Fracture in Post-Communist Eurasia. She's also non-resident senior scholar in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Professor Ohanian, thank you very much for joining us. The first question is, it's now been a year since the fighting began. What's the current status, the current conditions in this region?
Sure. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's good to be back in the scholar circle. The way the war has ended is a distinct category of conflict termination. Scholars who study armed conflicts distinguish between conflicts that end through negotiated settlements and conflicts that end through militarized victories, through war and the terminologies victory consolidation. And actually, this particular ending of a conflict, at least in this stage, the conflict is not terminated. We should state that. The key issue of the status over the disputed entity of Nagorno-Karabakh and the rights of the community in that entity are not discussed yet. But the mode of the way this particular conflict ended at this stage is quite telling as to what will transpire later on. In general, conflicts that end with militarized victory consolidation tend to deepen authoritarianism in victorious states. So this is based on large data of similar endings of conflicts. And we see this happening inside Azerbaijan, one of the conflict parties and the aggressor in this second war, 44-day war. The negotiated conflicts that do end through negotiated settlements all have a higher durability, more likelihood to last than any negotiated agreements to be implemented. Now, specifically for this conflict, since the conflict has ended with Russia brokered trilateral agreement, as you mentioned in your introduction, the agreement was very, very favorable to Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan recovered the territory surrounding the Nagorno-Karabakh entity, as well as the southern chunk of the entity itself. So the ceasefire agreement also has a stipulation of unblocking the region. So with all of this, which essentially unblocking the region would connect Azerbaijan to its entity, Nakhichevan, with which Azerbaijan does not share a border. So to simply state that the agreement is quite favorable to Azerbaijan, but yet since ending the war, the Aliyev regime has been using coercive diplomacy in the string of issues. The list of coercive actions that he has undertaken is really long. And many analysts argue that in this stage, actually even its close ally Turkey has not been supporting Aliyev. In particular, the conflict ended November 9th. Hostages were supposed to be returned, but yet Azerbaijan proceeded and captured over 200 hostages and prisoners of war and continued to keep them as bargaining chips. arguing for, asking for maps of landmines from Armenia. So that has been the negotiation between the two sides going on. In addition, Azerbaijan built a military victory park in doing a victory parade. And really, Aliyev regime is trying to milk the victory for domestic regime issues as well. But the victory park really dehumanized, continued to dehumanize Armenians, which makes it very difficult to build any peace process moving forward. The Victory Park is complete with wax statues of Armenian soldiers, helmets of soldiers who have died. But most importantly, there have been Azerbaijani soldiers actually moved into Armenian territory in three parts, wedged themselves there, arguing that there's need for border delimitation. While technically, I agree that there is need for border delimitation. This is a typical problem for the border between the two countries just reemerged after the Second War. So most post-imperial settings do go through border delimitations. And there are over 200 cases of border delimitation issues in post-Soviet space. However, this is border delimitation is a long process, decades long, usually carried out through civil servants, not through soldiers. So what Azerbaijan has been doing is very coercive, a lot more similar to, for example, what China has been doing in South China Sea than anything else. In parallel, there has been a trilateral commission formed by Russia, which includes governmental officials from Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Russia in order to work on blocking issues. But this process also has been quite secretive. And I believe that process has interrupted since Azerbaijan continues to stress Armenia's borders and Aliyev regime continues to make territorial claims on Armenia proper. To sum up this section, Azerbaijan has been insisting on peace on its terms, meaning that we will recognize Armenia's territorial integrity if you consider the conflict as ended. You recognize Azerbaijani territorial integrity, meaning that you do not speak of Nagorno-Karabakh anymore. This essentially what I call the tyranny of territorial integrity. While it is an international principle, international law, but at the same time, so is national self-determination and minority protection is hugely important. Studies do show that since 1970s, armed conflicts have been declining in parallel. There's a correlation between the decline of armed ethnic conflicts and in general onset of ethnic conflicts as accommodative capacities of states increase. And accommodative capacities include the measures like federalism, power sharing, territorial autonomy, to name a few. So simply concluded territorial autonomy without minority protections will continue to stress the international system, introducing further points of instability.
The Russians are supposed to play this security guarantee role. And then there was some expectation that the Russians would at least provide some degree of security for Armenians who had been kind of laid completely open, completely vulnerable to the Azerbaijanis as a result of Armenia's loss in this war. Is Russia not playing that role, or are they basically, are they taking a bit more of a backseat, or is there an expectation that Russia is going to play a pretty significant, pretty aggressive role?
That's a great question. So to clarify, Armenia has had not only bilateral security arrangements, agreements with Russia, but also Armenia is a member of Russia-led CS Collective Security Treaty Organization, Russia's answer to NATO, as well as Eurasian Economic Union. So Armenia really pushed and essentially aligned its security with Russia and Russia-centric institutions. During the war, Russia did not get involved, while Azerbaijan's main ally, Turkey, supported Azerbaijan in a very big way by supplying mercenaries, drone technology, military, political engagement, etc. Russia did not pick a side. I would argue that in this respect, Russia behaved in a more imperial way, not choosing a side, playing one side against the other, Arguing that Nagorno-Karabakh issue does not fall within Russia's security umbrella with Armenia, that it is not Armenia's border that is threatened. Okay, so far so good. I can see the argument. But since then, you're absolutely right. Azerbaijan has stressed, essentially, soldiers have entered the border in three places, and they actually do shoot on the international border. I actually drove through that area. Civilians are terrorized. I have seen Russian peacekeepers in Armenia in the southern part, but there are not that many. They are not that visible. I would argue that even though the international community recognized Azerbaijani coercive, quote-unquote, delimitation, border delimitation claims, pushing for Azerbaijan to move back, only Russia, Armenia's ally, stayed on a sideline and said that we need to form a committee, et cetera, et cetera. So I cannot say with confidence whether Russia does not want or is unable to provide the security that Armenia is entitled through various political and military treaties signed with Russia. I do think that we tend to overestimate Russia's control over this region. This is a fractured region, divided, and in this respect, while imperial powers or hegemonic powers will pursue this regional fracture to project their interests globally, at the same time, these fractured regions are also a liability. I don't think Russia is able to fully control Azerbaijan. Even though others will argue that Russia is doing this on purpose in order to pressure Armenia, I'm not sure, because I think by not standing by its security commitments, on the one hand, yes, it continues to not pick a side. It has all kinds of economic interests with oil-rich Azerbaijan. It's still a huge market for Azerbaijani products. But at the same time, its role, its claim as a security provider has been damaged tremendously. Mm-hmm. And if the agreement stipulates that Russia is support to provide, to be the broker, to be the security guarantor when the region is unblocked, it'd be very difficult to rely and trust that Russia has the capacity to do this.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the post-conflict conditions in the South Caucasus, the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, with Anna Ohanian. So you described earlier the way in which this military victory has entrenched authoritarian tendencies on the part of the Azerbaijani leadership of Aliyev. Is there also the same sorts of concerns, or at least the undermining of some of the legitimacy, certainly the popularity in Armenia? The Prime Minister Pashinyan really was kind of blamed for this war, and Armenia is a pretty relatively new democracy and a certain degree of fragility. Is there some real fears for democracy in Armenia as a result of this conflict?
Absolutely. Studies do show that heightened security environments, wars do stress democracy. They can produce democratic decline. So there's all kinds of research on the relationship between security and democracy. And as you noted, Armenia's democracy last year was only 2 years old. It was very nascent. What transpired since signing the ceasefire agreement was something significant. There was immediate backlash against the Pashinyan government for signing the agreement. It should be noted that the groups, while the public was overwhelmingly frustrated and traumatized and very upset with the way the war has handled, all kinds of questions were raised. But the political crisis on the streets, protests, were carried out by groups that were left out of the post-Velvet Parliament after Armenia went through its democratic breakthrough. Importantly, some of these forces were calling, and this was very, very dangerous few months, some of these forces were calling for the formation of so-called technocratic governments, or for essentially transitional governments, temporary governments. So, this would amount to a grabbing of power through the back door. These are the forces that were not elected, that were actually excluded from the parliament. Some of them aligned with the previous authoritarian systems. But what are the demonstrations, ironically, they did not grow in numbers, even though the public was upset. This really indicated that these groups did not have enough public support, but they have made enough pressure in for the Armenian political system to move towards snap elections. And this, I think, needs to be emphasized, the fact that Armenia succeeded in addressing, solving its political crisis institutionally through the ballot box. I think this was a sign of maturity of Armenian democracy. In parallel, there were political protests in Georgia. There was a political crisis in Georgia as well at the same time. And yet, in the case of Georgia, Europeans had to negotiate between the two political parties. So the fact that the snap elections took place and some of the forces that were protesting succeeded in managed to find their way into the parliament, even though it's much smaller presence, but still they're there, which I think is good because now their discontent moved into the institutional settings. So in that respect, I would say things are, and to add to that, the some of those, one person that was the key challenger was Robert Kocharyan, Armenia's second president, who has a legacy, painful legacy in Armenia for very violent handling of post-election protests in 2008 as a result of March 1st event, as a result of which Armenian citizens were killed by the military. Now, him campaigning, on the one hand, this would not have been the first time when the previous elite becomes elected in the new democratic parliament. This is very common. Over 75% of democratic transitions in the 20th century have produced these outcomes. But he was campaigning specifically to undo Armenia's, essentially limit Armenia's civic freedoms. He was campaigning on that quite openly on the grounds of security. In short, there was a very clear security versus democracy choice, forced dilemma, which I do think is a false choice. But that also, that fear of returning to any authoritarian system or losing the new political freedoms also played a role in Pashinyan's favor. Even though people were frustrated with him, they still ended up voting for him because they did not want to return to lose their democratic openness. So I think that's also significant that Armenia's democracy held pretty well.
Now, I know one of the concerns Armenians had was during the conflict was kind of the way the United States seemed to be pretty disengaged. A reminder that the Minsk group, really the US, Russia, and France, had been monitoring this region since the initial conflict, you know, had ended in the early 90s, 94, I believe it was. And the US didn't do terribly much. Has anything changed with respect to US foreign policy? Because, I mean, that obviously takes place under a different administration. Has the Biden administration taken any renewed interest in the region?
Well, Biden administration has been, in general, signaling that it is willing or is eager and interested in standing up for democracies in general, but also in standing up for human rights in general. So in the current post-war situation, a Russian peace, what I call the Russian peace, Russia brokered agreement, is pretty much in the hands of illiberal players. The outcome was coercive, continued coercive actions on Azerbaijani's side is unchallenged. These are all markers of what we call illiberal peace building, and they're dangerous in this. But there's still opportunity for OSCE Minsk group to revive and expand its role. And United States has declared, as well as the US ambassador in Armenia, Ambassador Tracy, has been several times stating that this conflict is not resolved, contrary to what Aliyev, President Aliyev insists, meaning that the core, the crux of the issue, the status of Nagorno-Karabakh, the fate of the population in Nagorno-Karabakh, Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh, this minority is not settled. There is room, and I think there is room for the United States to engage through the Minsk group. But I think at the very least, United States could really push Azerbaijan on at least on all of these coercive actions that it is carrying out. Biden proceeded to continue with the military aid to Azerbaijan despite gross violation of human rights and war crimes. Now there's another efforts within the House of Representatives to essentially push back and really make it impossible for America, for United States to fund, to provide military aid to Azerbaijan. So in this respect, I think there is a lot of, as United States is disengaged from Afghanistan in a very spectacular way, and will stating that it does not want to be the world's policeman. But at the same time, I hope it has been kind of swinging from one extreme to another. There are a lot of, Nagorno-Karabakh is a case of the middle ground. Also, so much that United States can do in putting its political capital pressure on finding a sustainable settlement on this conflict, because unresolved conflicts are front lines of authoritarianism. The longer this conflict remains unresolved, the higher the stakes of authoritarianism in Azerbaijan are going to be. And the regional resiliency will not be improved in any way. So I think there is a short between isolationism and full-blown military intervention. There are a lot of things that the United States can do. And Nagorno-Karabakh is a good case in point.
We've got a couple minutes left. What's the possibility that this is a conflict that actually can be resolved via a stable negotiated settlement, as opposed to kind of an expectation that since Armenia lost this war, that Armenians are rearming themselves and fully prepared, you know, to have another round of fighting? So is there a way that there could be some sort of stable resolution that both sides would agree to and could actually bring peace to the region? Or is the most reasonable expectation that there's actually going to probably be another round of fighting?
Many are worried that fighting might be renewed. The only mechanism for that to happen would be if the border escalation continues, if Aliyev continues to pressure the border. I see that as a mechanism. But for Armenia to rearm itself and engage in this revanchist war, I don't consider that likely. As a democratic states do need the openness. They do need economic prosperity. And wars kill both. So I don't expect, and after the war, Armenians are traumatized, but I don't think that they're ready for another round of fighting, or that they want another round of fighting. The negotiated settlement is the only outcome. This is an internationalized territorial conflict in terms of its type, the way scholars of peace and conflict research it. This particular types of conflicts are harder to negotiate. That is absolutely true. But at the same time, they also resist full-blown militarized final resolutions. Considering that this conflict has emerged as a part of Russia's geopolitical calculations, Turkey's geopolitical calculations, and Iran is also watching for a variety of reasons, the only solution is to find a negotiated settlement to this conflict. So far, I do consider Aliyev regime as the main driver that roadblock towards negotiated settlement. And he has purely domestic regime survival issues. Azerbaijan will be going through energy transitions, and that is really what's driving the behavior of the Aliyev regime. Declining oil prices, the end of oil.
We've been discussing the conflict in the Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh region between Azerbaijan and Armenia. 1 year later, a year ago, the fighting had started. The post-conflict challenges the countries face, and the ongoing conflict within the region. Our guest has been Anna Ohanian. She's the Richard B. Finnegan Distinguished Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Stonehill College. She's the author of The Neighborhood Effect, The Imperial Roots of Regional Fracture in Post-Communist Eurasia. And she's also a non-resident senior scholar in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Professor Ohanian, thank you very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you.
I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, the host and anchor, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant. All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.